Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who's fighting the war in Iraq? Our thoughts go instantly to the 150,000 or so troops on the ground, to their Iraqi allies, and to the insurgents determined to disrupt the mission. But those calculations leave out the shadow army of nearly as many people, also heavily armed and very much part of the fray. They are private security contractors, paid by private employers who contract with the Department of Defense to perform functions too taxing or too dangerous for the all-volunteer force to take on alone. They face similar dangers to their counterparts in the armed forces, but their motivations are often different, and they are working in an industry that operates almost entirely free of the regulations that the military uses to try to keep its members safe, honest, and disciplined. Steve Fenneroo has covered the industry as a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. He won this year's Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting, and his new book is called Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. Steve, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Let's start by defining this term private security contractor, because I gather that you consider it to be something of a euphemism.
I do. I use the word mercenary liberally in the book because I feel like it more accurately describes sort of the kind of work that's going on in Iraq. You know, I've really never felt comfortable with the term private security contractor. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands of armed people who have been integrated into the war. They're frequently experiencing combat. They're shot at. They're sometimes killed. They're returning fire, and they're sometimes killing people. And I felt like private security contractor, it's just simply too vague for the magnitude of the work that we're talking about.
How are they utilized by, or in some cases instead of, the armed forces?
Well, it varies. There are three basic types of work that they do. They protect people, like the U.S. ambassador or American generals or U.S. diplomats. You know, they protect military installations and strategic locations like warehouses, and they protect supply convoys that are unrelated to the military. That's a huge amount of material that's being protected because it involves, among other things, the entire reconstruction mission of Iraq, some $58 billion. So they're protecting weapons and ammunition going to the new Iraqi security forces. They're protecting material that's going to the new Iraqi ministries. They're protecting billions, literally billions of dollars of material.
Who gets hired to do jobs like these?
Well, it's primarily former military. That's sort of the basic profile, or people who have come out of law enforcement. But sort of when you get beyond that, it's a really diverse group. The coalition ended up hiring from all kinds of different countries and all kinds of different professions. There are former military people there from, of course, the U.S., from the U.K., from Australia, from Peru, from Fiji, from Chile, from many countries that really had nothing to do with the Iraq War. And then you had people, it really depended on the company. There were so many companies that kind of mushroomed overnight as part of this industry that it really ran the gamut. You had sort of more sophisticated companies with better resources, they were hiring more sophisticated personnel. And then you had companies that were really just they'd gotten some vehicles, they had hired some people and thrown together some weapons and were able to acquire contracts simply because there was so much security that was needed in Iraq when the insurgency intensified. And those companies often hired people with less experience or frankly no experience at all.
And you embedded yourself with a group called Crescent Security Group. Where would you put them on the continuum?
I would put them down sort of toward the bottom. Mm-hmm. I refer to them in the book as sort of the Kmart of private security.
Yeah, they were paying $84,000 a year when Blackwater's paying $240,000.
Well, they were paying their shooters or mercenaries or private security contractors or whatever you want to call them. They were paying their expats, the guys who had come from the U.S., $7,000 a month. But then they filled out their teams with Iraqis who were making $600 a month, often for the most dangerous work. You know, they sent their vehicles into Iraq with barely armored pickup trucks, which when I first saw it, I thought was, completely insane given the security environment. They moved back and forth across the Iraq-Kuwait border, and they kept their weapons in a shipping container on the Iraq side, and once, shortly after I'd gotten there, they opened up the shipping container and found that they had no weapons to work with in Iraq. And so they sent out $50,000 to buy weapons on the black market in Iraq and found that they had purchased some of their own weapons back. So it was sort of a fly-by-night operation. And the people who worked for it, you know, they really sort of ran the spectrum. There were people who had recently been in Iraq who had come out and found that they could come back for a lot more money than they had been making while they were in the military. And then there were people who hadn't been in the military for years, you know, not since the 1980s. And then they had come back because there was, you know, for various reasons, either they liked that kind of work or they needed the money. And then there were some people who had literally no experience at all. They hired one guy who was a tow truck operator who had who had met a couple guys at a U.S. military base. They hired a guy who was a former cage fighter. They hired they hired people who really had no business being in Iraq in that kind of situation.
And what sort of training would a Crescent Security Group give to their employees before they put them out in a war zone?
None. I mean, there was one guy who I met who had not been in the military since 1973. He was in his 50s, and he was working as a truck driver at a base up north of Baghdad. He had no experience using an AK-47, which was the weapon that that Crescent was using out in the field. You know, he met a guy who turned him onto the job, and basically the company came by, picked him up, handed him a weapon, and he was on his way. He said the training was on the job.
Steve Fanneroo is my guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. His new book is called Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. Did you get the sense, Steve, that Crescent at least considered its employees to be somewhat disposable?
You know, it's an interesting question, and I'm not quite sure how to answer it. You know, I think if you ask them, of course, they would say no. We value our employees; they're not disposable. But you know, the book follows the trajectory of five guys who worked for Crescent, who were kidnapped on Iraq's main supply route in broad daylight, and were ultimately mutilated and killed. And when you looked, the book dissects in some detail that kidnapping. And when you looked at it, Crescent had sent seven guys into Iraq to protect a supply convoy that stretched 1.5 miles in length. It was essentially indefensible. And when they got 3 miles into Iraq, they were attacked by basically a gang of armed men that numbered somewhere between 40 and 60 men. And so when you ask whether the company looked at its employees as disposable, circumstances around the kidnapping would suggest that they did not take the ultimate precautions in terms of providing safety for their employees.
Yeah, in the book, you're really able to tell the story in an extraordinarily rich way because by a horrible bit of luck, these people that you happen to have profiled and become quite close to in some cases were kidnapped before you even had a chance to write your initial story about them, which was simply going to be about the operation and what it was to be a private security contractor.
Exactly. I mean, I had gone back to Iraq and sort of embedded with this company because I really wanted to answer certain sort of basic questions about, you know, who they were, what they did, what their role was in the war, how much fighting they were engaged in. And so I hung out with them for about a week, and I got to know them, and I traveled around with them. And then I came back to the States, and within a few days of returning, I got a phone call telling me that they had been kidnapped. And, you know, it was frankly horrifying because, I really had grown to like these people, and they had very complicated reasons for being in Iraq. You know, the main character in the book, who I became friendly with and whose family I became quite close with, he had been in the 82nd Airborne Division as a paratrooper, and he had served in Afghanistan and Iraq. He came out of the military, and he enrolled at the University of Florida as an accounting major. And what he found was that he just could not reintegrate into his life. It should have been utopia for him. He was an incredibly charismatic guy, impossibly good-looking guy who was suddenly, you know, surrounded in Florida by beautiful women and partying and without any of the restrictions that he'd had in the military. But he felt like his his life was superficial. It in no way matched the intensity of the experience that he'd had in Iraq. And so his response to that had been a friend of his offered him a job, you know, making $7,000 a month for this obscure company protecting supply convoys in Iraq. And so he went back to Iraq to try to sort of work out whatever was going on in his head. It was really tragic because, you know, he had learned after he got there that the company was obviously extremely messed up, that the work was far more dangerous than what he had been doing even in the military, and that, you know, he really didn't belong there. He had told his family and his friends and me, you know, that he was coming home, and before he could, he was kidnapped and of course, later killed.
You have a great scene in the book where you describe riding around with him in one of these sort of barely armored, what amounted to a pickup truck. You had the sense somehow that you were safe, even though you knew at the time that was completely an illusion.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, I had spent a lot of time in Iraq myself before I started reporting on this. And, you know, I think I really felt that, you know, these guys, especially John Cote, who's the main character in the book and the guy I was riding with, you know, these guys had convinced me that the routes that they were running in southern Iraq were safe. I knew how dangerous it was in Iraq because I'd seen it firsthand, and yet somehow being around them, they'd convinced me that this particular route was safe. And it's interesting because when I was writing the book and piecing it all together, it struck me how incredibly ludicrous that illusion was and how much was going on with not only with the company but in Iraq at the time and the sort of specifics about Crescent Security Group that made the situation so dangerous. And yet, I think we convince ourselves, we want to believe certain things about our circumstances, and those beliefs become a reality, I think, until that it's shown to be otherwise.
Is that a survival mechanism that you saw in enlisted soldiers as well?
Yeah, I think so. Although, you know, with the military, it was just such a different game over there. You know, the military would travel in these very circumscribed areas where they, you know, they just drove around a particular sector of a particular city, and they patrolled those areas, and that was their sector, and they really didn't get out of that. With the private security guys, they were wandering everywhere. They were all over Iraq. And so there was a sense, you know, that the freedom that they had and the lack of regulation that they had, I think, provided them a weird sense of security that maybe that they had not felt in the military.
They couldn't get in trouble.
They couldn't get in trouble. They could move around much more quickly if they needed to. They could drive, you know, 100 miles an hour. Or they could drive against traffic. The military, everything was just much more rigid and structured. And, you know, and with Crescent Security Group, I mean, in the military, the vehicles were better. But I don't know, I don't feel like I'm explaining it very well, but somewhere in that freedom that they had, I think they sort of adopted this illusion of safety as well.
Steve Fainaru is my guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. His new book is called Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Washington Post correspondent Steve Faneru is my guest this hour. His new book is called Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. If you want to join us, send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Do these guys bond in the same way that soldiers do?
Yes and no. I think one of the reasons why a lot of people enjoyed the work was that it replicated the camaraderie, you know, that they felt when they were in the military. But at the same time, they were independent contractors, so they could literally walk away from their jobs at any time, which, of course, you know, is a crime in the military. So you'd hear these stories of people who would get out of their trucks and literally walk back to the Kuwait border, or disappear in the middle of the night. That kind of thing happened frequently. The contractors, they called it the circuit. They'd literally hop from contract to contract, you know, looking for the better deal. And they'd move throughout Iraq working for all kinds of different companies. I mean, I've known people who have done this work who have worked for a half dozen companies or more during the course of the war, just moving from one contract to another. So I think the bond is, it's different by definition almost, because the work is so transient.
So we've already talked about the fact, Steve, that there were not the same kinds of rules and disciplinary accountability that there would have been in the military. We've heard multiple accounts of brutality by these security contractors and the fact that they were sort of operating in a way that made them seem above the law. Does this profession draw people who might not fit into a place where they're expected not to indiscriminately kill or wound people or destroy property?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think that, you know, I think the people who come into the job, I think they've been trained. Many of them have been trained with the United States military. And when they come back to the job, you know, they're bringing those skills. What I think happened was, particularly in the case of a company like Blackwater, you had absolutely zero oversight. And so Blackwater, which was working for the State Department, was getting involved in a series of questionable shooting incidents over a long period of time. And when there was never any discipline that was associated with those actions, or really any even formal investigation into what had occurred, when the State Department was essentially deferring to Blackwater on all matters related to security, that produced its own lawlessness. And I think that's what happened. I don't think necessarily people came over there, you know, inherently evil, and that they were coming over to simply act out on impulses that they had and were able to exploit.
Do you think, Steve, that everyday Iraqis make a distinction between private security contractors who are not accountable to the State Department or the U.S. military and the U.S. military?
No, definitely not. And the security contractors themselves would tell you that, you know, when they got attacked by the insurgents. I mean, the insurgents obviously were attacking U.S. interests in Iraq. They weren't differentiating between the conventional forces and the private security forces. And then for the Iraqi populace, when they would see these people, you know, barreling through traffic circles or opening fire indiscriminately and not being punished, they weren't differentiating between Blackwater and Aranus and any number of, you know, other companies. They were all Americans. And I think there was a feeling not only among Iraqis but also among Americans that it had become an incredibly destructive thing for the U.S. mission in Iraq, because if the overall U.S. mission was ultimately to win over the Iraqi population, you know, these people were ultimately undermining it through these acts.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Steve Faneru's new book is called Big Boy Rules. Let's speak to Terry in Dallas. Hello, Terry.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I just wanted to let the author know I was in Barnes & Noble the other day and hadn't gone in there specifically to pick up the book, but I saw it and looked at the front cover and thought it was pretty interesting. So I thought, okay, well, I'll have to make this my next read. In the meantime, I was just wondering, is the fellow in the picture on the front cover the guy that you've been talking about, this John guy, or is there another, like a short story you can tell without giving too much away of the story?
Sure, yeah. Thanks for picking up the book. And, yeah, the guy who's on the cover, his name is Jake Washburn. He was an employee for Triple Canopy, which is another private security company that shares a contract with the State Department with Blackwater. And so his story is that according to some of his colleagues, he announced one day that he really felt like shooting someone. And, you know, the people he worked with sort of regarded it as an offhanded remark. He was kind of given to sort of such statements, they said. But that afternoon, according to the other three people in the vehicle with him, he pushed open his door and fired several rounds from his weapon into the windshield of a passing civilian taxi, and then sped off. That's where I first heard the expression "big boy rules," which the contractors told me essentially meant that we know we operate under our own rules. And in this case, when this incident was reported, there was clearly no real legal mechanism to deal with it. And so what ultimately happened was he was fired from his job, but the people who reported the incident, who had effectively reported the crime, were also fired.
And there are even some questions as to how these people would be prosecuted if that were to take place in terms of jurisdiction, and are they prosecuted in their home state or county? Are they prosecuted there in Iraq?
Yeah, I think it's really problematic. In 2004, the head of the U.S. occupation government, L. Paul Bremer, signed an edict granting private contractors immunity from the Iraqi criminal justice system. And so when that happened, the question then became, well, what laws are they governed by? And that question has never really been cleared up. There's a civilian contractor law that people think may apply to their actions. Some people have tried to place them under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. But it's very problematic. My feeling has always been that ultimately the issue is not the law as much as it is enforcement. Obviously, you need laws to govern people who are operating in a battle space. But my question always was, who's going to enforce it?
Steve Vanderoo is my guest. His book is called Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. Let's go next to Kevin in Dallas. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, I look forward to reading the book. Various friends of mine in the military who have, you know, obviously been quite patriotic refer to President Bush as the idiot prince, and he's soon going to be landing back on Dallas's doorstep again. I'm curious as to what the perspective of both the contractor people you dealt with and the military whom you spoke with, how their positions on Mr. Bush have evolved. I saw a editorial in the New York Times this Sunday from Rumsfeld, who was once again defending their position. So I'll get off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. Well, the one thing I can say is that, you know, the Bush administration and including former Secretary Rumsfeld were really almost completely clueless when it came to sort of the actions of these people on the battlefield. There's a scene in the book where Rumsfeld is actually asked by a graduate student at Georgetown what rules apply to private military contractors in Iraq. And he kind of stammers through an answer and ultimately essentially says that they're covered by Iraqi law, which, of course, was completely untrue. And then, simply coincidentally, 3 months later, the president himself showed up at Georgetown, and the same woman got up to ask the question to the president. And his response literally was, "Help," he said to the audience, because he had no idea. And I don't think he really even knew the magnitude of what was happening. You know, the military, I think, regarded the private private security contractors, the mercenaries, with a kind of mixture of curiosity, resentment, and awe. You know, resentment because of the enormous amounts of money that they were making for doing the same jobs that they were doing, getting paid a lot less. But, you know, curiosity about sort of how they might be able to get a job and get that much money and, you know, and those freedoms.
2006 census figures estimated there were about 100,000 American contractors working in Iraq. I don't know how close those numbers are to what the levels are now.
I think it's a misunderstood figure. The last figure I saw actually was 190,000 contractors, which was about, at the time, was about 30,000 more private contractors working in Iraq than there were actual troops. Now, many of those people are people who are doing jobs like driving trucks or working in chow halls or doing repairs on bases or, you know, all manner of jobs. The guys that I'm focusing on in the book are a sort of a niche group out of that much larger figure. And it's still not known how many of those there are. The Pentagon's own estimate is 25,000, which in and of itself is a huge number. It's, you know, more than an entire division of people running around the battlefield. You know, some people estimate as much as 50,000 or even higher.
And when they are killed, they are not added to the total of American casualties for the war.
Yeah, I think the use of these guys really obscures the true cost of the war. They're not counted at all. I mean, they're not counted in troop levels when they're deployed, and they're certainly not killed when they're not counted when they're killed or wounded or kidnapped, as you know, as I describe with the guys in the book. You know, John Cote, I mean, here was a guy who had, you know, he was a decorated U.S. military veteran who had served in two wars. He went back to Iraq to perform military functions, but when he was killed, I mean, he didn't even merit a statistic. And I always felt that was by design. You know, it hides the political cost, it hides the human toll of the war that we continue to be engaged in.
What's your best guess, Steve, about how many of these guys have lost their lives?
You know, it's really hard to say. The Department of Labor keeps figures on insurance claims that are made through what's called the Defense Base Act. You know, and there it's in the hundreds at this point of private contractors. But, of course, they don't break it down by private security contractor or regular contractor or what have you. I would say easily it's in the thousands of people, because we're not talking about Iraqis or the third country nationals, people from other countries who are coming to do these jobs. We just don't know, like a lot of things in Iraq.
When your five were kidnapped, there's a really chilling story in the book. There was a point at which everyone sort of assumed that they had already been killed. And I guess a reporter met Ahmed Chalabi and mentioned them. And he said, oh, no, they're not dead. I know they're not dead. And she said, well, how do you know this? And he showed her a video.
Exactly. The reporter's name was Hana Alam. She was working in Baghdad for McClatchy News Service. And she went out to see Chalabi just on another story. At this point, it was about a month into the kidnapping. And, you know, there had been no word at all, no videos, no ransom demands, nothing. And so there was a great deal of uncertainty surrounding, you know, whether they had simply just disappeared. And so Hana talked to Chalabi, and as you said, they got into a conversation about who was worse, the Sunnis or the Shia. And Chalabi, of course, who's Shia, said, well, the Sunnis are worse because they cut off the heads when they kidnap people. And Hana's response was, well, let's see what happens with those Crescent security guys when they turn up. And Chalabi's response was, no, they're alive. And he then proceeded to produce this video on his computer, but he told her that he had done nothing with it. He was afraid at that point of going to the Americans, he said, because he was afraid of getting involved and how it might be construed. And Hana, who has two brothers who are in the Marines, you know, of course, was mortified. You know, she said to Chalabi, well, you have to go to the Americans. You know, they have families, people have families and who are concerned about them. They would want to know that they're alive. And so finally, he allowed her to do an audio recording of the video, and then she reported it. But at the time, Chalabi still wouldn't allow her to identify him as the source, and so the incident sort of came and went, with the FBI wondering what the source of the video was, and Hana being unable to say anything.
And Chalabi at that point had moved from working in the coalition government to he was then sort of aligned completely with Muqtada al-Sadr.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It was very much, according to Chalabi, I interviewed him for the book, and, you know, he said that, I asked him whether, because his situation with the American government had changed, whether that affected the way he approached this. And he said something like, perhaps. Because, you know, at that point he had gone from America's leading ally in Iraq to someone who was accused of being aligned with Muqtada al-Sadr and the Iranian government.
And so once the families finally were aware that their loved ones were alive or might have been alive at a point in the recent past, they were still encouraged not to sort of go public with what they knew. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the U.S. government told them that, you know, it might play into the kidnappers' hands. They didn't want publicity about the case. They thought that would somehow give the kidnappers the publicity that they wanted. And of course, they didn't want to negotiate with the kidnappers. So there was a great deal of, you know, the and families were lost. They simply did not know what to do. And at the same time, I think one of the things that was really being pointed up was the differences in the way missing U.S. soldiers were treated by the U.S. government and the way missing contractors were treated. While this was going on, there was an incident in which three soldiers were abducted south of Baghdad, and the U.S. military deployed thousands of soldiers to try to search for them in the palm groves south of Baghdad. And in fact, more soldiers were killed during that search. But at the same time, you had these five Americans who were missing, and it was the largest kidnapping of Americans since the start of the war. And yet there was this perception that the U.S. government was doing nothing. The case had the kidnapping had occurred in southern Iraq near the city of Basra, and yet the FBI was managing the case out of the Green Zone, and the case was being headed out of Washington, D.C. It wasn't until the DEA got involved, because John Cote, the main character in my book, was the stepson of a DEA agent in Buffalo. It wasn't until the DEA got involved that someone was actually sent to Basra to investigate the case, and not long after that, the bodies were recovered.
Well, the irony of that, of course, is that the DEA has absolutely no jurisdiction over what's taking place in Iraq.
Exactly. The DEA got involved because the DEA agent, who was the stepmother of John Cote, had pushed the case, and because there was a DEA agent who was familiar with Nancy Cote, is her name, who wanted to get involved. And he freely admitted that he'd never investigated a kidnapping in his two-decade career, but he got involved because he felt it was right.
Steve Fainarou is with us. We're talking about his new book, Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment and invite you to get on the line to join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent Steve Fainarou is here. He works for the Washington Post. He's just published a book called Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Steve, some people have called for a ban on the use of private security contractors. Could U.S. forces, though, such as they are, survive without these guys?
Well, not in Iraq, they couldn't. And I think that that's been proven. I mean, one of the interesting things about the whole Blackwater mess was that when Blackwater was involved in a shooting in September 2007 where 17 Iraqis were killed in a traffic circle, there was immediate outrage, and the Iraqi government immediately said that Blackwater itself would be banned in Iraq and that the shooters who were involved would be prosecuted inside Iraq. Within 3 days, Blackwater had repainted their trucks, and they were moving around business as usual. And what it pointed up really was that the only entity that controlled Blackwater in Iraq was the State Department. But not only that, that if Blackwater itself were banned in Iraq, then the State Department would have ceased to function. That's true of a lot of different issues in Iraq. I mean, particularly the State Department's activities and the whole reconstruction of Iraq, which is being handled primarily by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The Corps uses private security for all of the protection of its reconstruction material. The reconstruction would effectively shut down without private security.
So there's, I guess, reason to believe that even after U.S. troops leave in any kind of military capacity, that these security contractors could stay to protect the ongoing reconstruction.
Well, I think it's going to be very interesting to see exactly what happens. When I was last in Iraq, you know, the the Private Security Company Association of Iraq, which is sort of an industry trade group, they were telling me that they were looking forward to the transition in Iraq. They were looking at sectors like the oil services industry, where clearly, as the oil sector was opening up, those people were going to need protection. Iraq obviously is less is more dangerous now than it was a year ago, but it's still a very dangerous place. And so private security is going to be needed. And so I think there is a sense that as the U.S. tries to draw down, that private security would not necessarily move in a parallel fashion and, in fact, might increase.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Ramus in Carrollton. Hi, Ramus.
Hi. Supposedly our government wants to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people. Now, you know, it doesn't make sense. If we got people that our government pays to run around and kill civilians, obviously either we don't really want to or care to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people. Or, I mean, how are we expected to do that? And another thing I was going to say, you know, after September 11, a lot of Americans were, well, what have we done wrong? We haven't deserved this. Well, I have followed American government's policies and actions all around the world. And now everybody knows that we've got mercenaries that our government pays in there to kill people, right? So let's say, hypothetically, another September 11 happens. American people are capable of coming out again and acting like, well, what have we done wrong? We are these peaceful people. You know, I mean, I expected when I dial your number right now not to be able to get through. But guess what? I got through right away. You know why? Because American people don't care about these people and their action. They only care about abortion, gay rights, you know, and the right to bear arms and nothing else. So well, we shouldn't be surprised if we get hit again if we behave in this matter.
I do appreciate your call, Ramus. And we do have multiple lines, which helps explain how you got through. But thanks very much for your call. Do you want to respond to that, Steve?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, one of the things that's interesting since the book was published is the comments by many people who believe that these modern mercenaries were hired to kind of do the dirty work for the U.S. government in Iraq and that the fact that there were no laws that applied to their actions is by design. You know, I don't really believe that. And I think when you look at the State Department, it's a much more complicated picture. The State Department, many people have remarked to me in frustration, you know, here's an agency that was created to promote diplomacy among people and nations. And here they are using a company, Blackwater, that was undermining those goals with its posture and with its actions in the streets of Iraq. Now, I don't think that was because the State Department was wanting Blackwater to go out and shoot people. I think it was because the State Department wanted to stay safe, and they had a private company that was willing to keep them safe come hell or high water. And so they were doing everything they could. And if the price of that safety for all of their employees was some dead Iraqis in a very difficult security environment, that was a price that they were willing to pay.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jim in Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Well, I actually, this sort of segues from what you were just saying. I'd like to know more about the history of how this utilization of mercenaries came into being, and who from the military or from the government in our country are profiting from this.
Thanks for your call.
Uh-huh.
Sure. My view is that the military has been privatizing for several years now, but I think what happened in Iraq was very much specific to Iraq. You had a situation where the Bush administration simply failed to provide enough troops for the type of mission in Iraq. And then when the insurgency intensified and the security environment became untenable, you had an industry of arms that literally grew up overnight in Iraq, hundreds of companies that were providing this kind of work. I think that's principally how it evolved. What was the second part of the question?
I think he was asking about the Bush administration. Let me segue the question into this. Yeah. Do you think it was a face-saving measure on the part of the Bush administration, having realized that its promises that the war would be over quickly and easily?
I think it was a matter of desperation. Mm-hmm. Everybody needed security, I mean, including the Washington Post and, you know, the media and humanitarian organizations. You know, you had the International Republican Institute that was out there, chaired by John McCain, promoting democracy projects in Iraq and using mercenaries to move between those projects. You had the National Democratic Institute, chaired by Madeleine Albright, doing the same thing with their own projects and needing security to do it. You had USAID. You had the Corps of Engineers. It was something that there was supply, there was demand for security, and people rushed in to meet that demand. I really do think that that's the great majority of sort of what happened in Iraq with this industry was related to that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Brian in Fort Worth. Hi, Brian.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Okay. First, I'd like to respond to the caller a few calls ago saying that we Americans don't care about the what's going on in Iraq. And I think if it could be of any kind of consolation, the latest election showed that we do care and we want change in that situation. And this kind of dovetails into my next question for you. Is the Obama administration going to be scaling back its reliance on these contractors, or are we going to just be seeing, you know, where we're hamstrung and we have to rely on them because of the recruiting issue that's going on with the military?
Right. I think it's a really good question, and I don't think we have the answer yet. You know, I guess I've always felt that it was going to be a lot harder to get out of Iraq than it was to get in. And so I think we're going to have to see. You know, Obama, as a senator, was a proponent of greater regulation for the private security industry, and yet he's been unwilling to come out and support an all-out ban on their use. And there's a reason for that. It's just simply untenable at this point. The mission in Iraq, the drawdown would collapse if you didn't have private security involved in all manner of different areas in Iraq. And I think that his unwillingness to support a ban is related to that more than anything else. It's just untenable at this point to suddenly pull them out of there. Now, what will happen as America draws down, it really remains to be seen, because I don't think we know exactly what's going to happen in Iraq as the drawdown occurs. If violence suddenly escalates again, the drawdown might stall. You would need more private security in Afghanistan, which seems to be getting worse. And there are all kinds of different sort of scenarios that I could see, but I don't see Obama supporting a ban in Iraq on private security anytime soon.
What's the protocol right now if a private security contractor, let's say, shoots and kills an Iraqi civilian? Let's even assume that it might have been justified for whatever reason. Is a report filed? Do they have to go and sort of bring the body to official custody? What happens?
Well, that's one of the issues that's sort of laid out in the book. It was never really entirely clear, and a lot of it related to whatever contract you were on. If you were a company that was under a contract to the Pentagon, then you might be subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and you're supposed to report shooting incidents to a sort of command center that was designed by the military to monitor civilian contractors on the battlefield. But in fact, the people who ran that center told me that just a handful of some three dozen companies that were under that command actually reported. So the numbers that they saw were meaningless, and they really had no idea how many shooting incidents were occurring. And then when you looked at the State Department side, it was even more nebulous, because you had Blackwater and Triple Canopy and DynCorp, who were under state, who were completely divorced from just about everything that was happening with the military. And this is impossible, really, to get a read on exactly how many shooting incidents were occurring, how many people were being shot, what was happening to them. There was a company called URG that, right after the Blackwater incident, killed two women in Baghdad on a road. And when I began to look into that shooting, it turned out that they had internally reported 37 shooting incidents over the previous 2 years to their employer, which was another private company, which in turn was employed by the U.S. By USAID, which of course is sort of affiliated with the State Department. But when I went to the U.S. government to try to find out what, if anything, had happened with these shooting incidents, they said, USAID does not have anything to do with the security of its contractors, and so they didn't know.
And what that whole incredibly complex series of events that you write about, where that leads us is to the fact that even if there were greater regulations, as President-elect Obama has mentioned and other people have advocated, there's not really any good way to make sure that they get enforced.
I think that's true. You know, a lot of people even now are kicking around sort of what laws should be applied to the contractor's actions. And, of course, there should be laws. I think everybody agrees on that. But it's never been clear to me who was going to enforce these laws. I think the Blackwater case will be very instructive because there's been a grand jury sitting for 14 months on that case in D.C. There have been rumors of indictments, but even now it's unclear what charges would be brought, where the cases would be tried, how evidence would be presented. I mean, you can imagine how difficult it is investigating this kind of shooting in the middle of a war. And so I think it's extremely problematic.
What were you really searching for when you went to tell the story in the first place? And I don't necessarily mean the facts, but what did you want to really understand about our presence in Iraq?
When I first started looking into this, I'd covered the military for 14 months, and I vaguely knew about the presence of these people on the battlefield. And I wanted to know really basic questions, I think, you know, sort of what role did they play in the war? What did it mean to have private security contractors of this scope on the battlefield? Who were they? You know, why would people take these jobs? And I think the thing that struck me most from the very beginning was the sheer enormity of the practice, the incredible numbers of people who were not only willing to do the job, but had been employed in the simplest way. You know, you have people who applied for jobs over the internet and got hired, and now they were fighting the war. And what you realized was that the Bush administration, because of the circumstances in Iraq, had effectively outsourced the decision of who can kill and die for our country, you know, to these private companies that were in Iraq for the primary reason to make money. And that in itself, I think, really, I think for me, it was really an extraordinary thing to see. You know, I think I could have written, you know, different books about Iraq, but I felt like in the end, for me, this was the one that somehow symbolized the whole experience in Iraq and sort of summed up what it was.
Steve Fanarou is a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. His book is called Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. Steve, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.